The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Double September-October 2021 issue. We begin with our cover story, Not Set in Stone. Scientists once thought that personality doesn't change much once you reach your 30s, but an influx of new research points to the various ways it can evolve over time. If you are a rat, the smell of cat urine would likely scare you as much as a rattlesnake's hiss. But the rat navigating a maze for Joanne Webster, pathobiologist at London's Royal Veterinary College, was no ordinary specimen. As it explored the labyrinth that stretched ahead, cautiously at first, then more boldly, the rat stumbled upon a strange smell wafting from one of the corners. The scent seemed to draw it in. What the cat found so tempting, as did many of his lab mates tested in the maze, was indeed cat urine, turned somehow from rodent repellent to love potion. The rats had previously been infected with Toxoplasma gondii, a brain parasite that, as the scientists running the trials were learning, considerably altered the way the rats behaved. Not only did they display this potentially fatal, certainly ill-advised feline attraction, but they were also more eager to explore the maze than uninfected animals were. For better or for worse, their rat personality had changed towards a higher level of openness to experience. Research shows that human personality can change too, sometimes even dramatically, and not just because of a parasitic infection. In fact, personalities can fluctuate with age, shift because of life events, and even change due to things we ingest. What's more, we can actually alter our personalities with our own efforts, and making those changes may be simpler than we think. Back in the 1990s, it was generally believed that adult personality was fixed, at least so long as the brain remains intact. In other words, it doesn't change much once we hit our 30s. Thanks to an influx of new studies, however, researchers are now discovering that personality is actually quite malleable over time. If you test and retest someone over a period of 10 years, there's roughly a 25% chance that their personality traits will change, according to a study co-authored by Brent Roberts, a personality researcher at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And the longer you wait between tests, the higher the likelihood that the person's agreeableness, being polite, kind, and friendly, neuroticism, a tendency towards anxiety, self-doubt, and low emotional stability, or conscientiousness, being responsible, reliable, and hardworking, will undergo considerable shifts. Old views die hard. Even some academics hold the belief that personality doesn't change, says Roberts. I have found this attitude to be immune to the data. Sometimes, though, it's easy to overlook the various ways our personalities change over the years. Why? Because similar shifts might be happening to our peers, too. Many of us look at our early youth with dismay, criticizing how reckless and self-centered we were. Research shows that as the years pass, most people's personality changes toward the more conscientious, less neurotic, and more agreeable behavior, which basically means getting along well with others. Similar patterns have been found all across the planet, from Germany and Italy to Estonia, South Korea, and Japan. When you compare yourself to your peers, simultaneously you can look to be the same person, but also be changing, because everybody is getting more conscientious, or everybody is getting less neurotic, says Roberts. Scientists call this the maturity principle, since most people would agree that becoming more emotionally stable and conscientious, specifically more diligent and organized, is a good thing. Plus, some degree of change happens to almost everyone. In one 2019 study, as many as 97.9% of people showed shifts in personality traits across a 50-year period. For most participants, the changes were modest, but for a few, they were large by psychological standards. We find that some people really seem to undergo dramatic changes, says Wiebke Blydorn, a psychologist at the University of California, Davis. A growing batch of recent studies suggests that adult personality can be altered at any age, though as Blydorn and her co-authors show in a 2017 study, the magnitude of such shifts is by far the greatest for people in their 20s. And after we hit our 80s, the general pattern of change is no longer for the better. In one Scottish study which followed people for 6 years after the age of 81, their extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness all declined significantly as they grew older. As a system, we tend to deteriorate as we get closer to dying, and personality traits are kind of an indirect indicator of our overall functioning, says Roberts. Some researchers argue that such personality developments, first becoming nicer and more responsible with age, then more grumpy and fickle, may be biologically built into our species, a bit like children's developmental milestones. What seems to support this theory is the fact that personality maturation is universal across cultures. This holds true as well in observations of chimpanzees, who turn more agreeable and conscientious as they age. It seems that there is also something like a genetic program that drives personality maturation, says Blydorn. Most scientists today agree that the way our personality traits shift with time is not only simply biological, though. Our environment likely plays a role, too. These changes may follow predictable life events and common experiences, like falling in love, graduating, becoming a parent, and later, retiring. Personality tends to be at its most stable in midlife. Blydorn believes that this may be due to the fact that this is also the period when someone's environment is more consistent. Most people are done with having children, live in the same house, have a stable social network, maybe the same romantic partner, which may have to do with their stability and personality, she says. On the other hand, in early youth, we experience both a lot of novelty and a lot of personality change. For example, researchers have studied how people's first serious relationships can trigger such shifts. In a German study published in Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, adults who started their first romantic partnerships between the ages of 18 and 30 became considerably less neurotic and more conscientious compared to those who remained single. What's more, as Blydorn notes, these positive effects remain even if the people break up. Getting your first job also seems to predictably change people for the better. Another 2011 German study found that entering the labor market boosts conscientiousness. We become more likely to show up on time, pay our bills, and work hard. Meanwhile, if you happen to be a married woman, and you've noticed that since the wedding your husband is happy to trade his party outfits for slippers, you are not alone. One study done on more than 300 heterosexual spouses, specifically 169 married pairs, living in Florida, showed that over the first 18 months of marriage, new husbands became much less extroverted. For those who find this disappointing, the upside is that said husbands also became more conscientious. That is, more likely to deal with dirty dishes in the sink and pay bills on time. The personality of the wives, on the other hand, showed an uptick in emotional stability after their vows. For instance, they became less easily upset and less prone to worrying. Admittedly, the evidence on how marriage changes personality is not yet as strong as it is with first jobs or first relationships. The same goes for the transition to parenthood or divorce. While some researchers have found that becoming a mom or a dad makes people more neurotic, think of all the new reasons to worry, and less conscientious, which makes sense given all the new demands on their time, most studies find no differences in personality between parents and people without kids. Retirement, meanwhile, can sometimes cause increases in agreeableness, but not all studies show these effects. Divorce is a mixed bag, too. For some, it means more extroversion, for others, less. Roberts has an explanation for such confusing results. It's not the event per se, but your experience of it, he says. It's not the divorce, but whether it was a good divorce or a bad divorce. That's far more important when it comes to personality change. Major life events like divorce or retirement likely affect our personality in the first place because they change our everyday behaviors and thought patterns. If sustained, these changes in behaviors can lead to deeper, more substantial shifts in personality traits. After all, personality traits are nothing more than a sum of personality states, moment-to-moment feelings, actions, and beliefs. When you work on these, you can alter your personality. Practice makes perfect, as the saying goes. If you would like to change your personality, at least some part of your personality, you're in good company. A staggering 87 to 97% of people said they would too, in a 2014 survey with 200 plus participants published in the Journal of Research in Personality. Conscientiousness topped the wish list of desired traits. Luckily, given the proper tools, says Roberts, people can indeed alter their personality. In one experiment, university students entered a 15-week program designed to help them change their personality traits. The whole idea was based on the oft-referenced adage to fake it till you make it. Each week, the students received a list of challenges through a computer program. These ranged from very easy, like saying hello to a cashier at a store to boost extroversion, to more difficult, say arriving 5 minutes early for appointments to bolster conscientiousness. The students had to choose several tasks off a list, with the program suggesting more and more demanding options as the trial progressed. It all worked quite well. For example, those who wanted to increase their extroversion and completed 2 challenges per week managed to reliably increase that particular personality dimension over the semester. While these changes don't take a lifetime to accomplish, they don't happen overnight either. Personality interventions, on average, require 24 weeks to bring out marked changes, according to a recent analysis of over 200 studies. Neuroticism appears to be relatively malleable. In these experiments, people became considerably more emotionally stable in just 4 weeks. One question that remains unanswered is how long such effects last. Roberts suspects that the best analogy here is physical exercise. If I only try a little bit, it's probably not going to have a lasting effect, he says. There are some things, however, that can change your personality with almost zero effort on your part, but with some potentially nasty side effects. Humans are no rodents, but research indicates that Toxoplasma gondii infection can affect our personalities too. Studies show that infected people are less conscientious and more extroverted than those who are Toxoplasma gondii free. What's more, at least 40 studies have by now linked toxoplasmosis with schizophrenia. Almost everything we've seen in rats has been seen in people too, right down to this bizarre attraction to the smell of cat urine, says pathobiologist Webster, one of the authors of the study on infected rats. Toxoplasma gondii is a tiny parasite that you can pick up from eating undercooked meat or by changing a cat's litter box. These single-celled organisms impact behavior because they're trying to maximize transmission from an intermediate host, such as a rodent, to its definitive host, which is the feline, Webster says. Experiments on rodents suggest that cysts of the parasite present in the brain can alter levels of dopamine, a neurotransmitter that plays a role in reward and motivation. When a rodent is more motivated to explore and more attracted to cat urine, it's more likely to be gobbled up by a cat, thereby spreading the parasite. Webster believes that Toxoplasma gondii's impacts on humans are just a knock-on effect that wasn't intended for our species. Yet the parasite doesn't know what host species it's in, and will influence the behavior of rodents and humans alike. Eating undercooked meat is probably not the smartest way to change your personality, but for many people, altering certain traits could have a considerable payoff. High levels of conscientiousness, openness to experience, emotional stability, and agreeableness have all been linked to relationship satisfaction, academic achievement, job performance, and even how long we live. Being very conscientious can lower a person's mortality risk by 44%, more than even the best Mediterranean diet. If we could put conscientiousness into a pill, it would be the most successful pharmaceutical in history, says Roberts. Frontline fatigue. Military nurses in World War II experienced PTSD that was left untreated and often denied altogether, driving many from the profession. Can we do better for today's nurses? In February 1945, U.S. Navy nurse Dorothy Still was a prisoner of war in the Japanese-occupied Philippines. Along with 11 other Navy nurses, Nurse Still provided care for civilian inmates in a prison camp where food was scarce and guards were brutal. Few inmates weighed more than 100 pounds, and most were dying from malnutrition. On the night of February 22nd, Nurse Still and the other inmates watched as their captors set up guns around the perimeter of the camp and turned the barrels inward. Other guards dug shallow graves. The inmates had long suspected the camp commander planned to kill them all, and it seemed the rumors were coming true. Yet Nurse Still and another Navy nurse reported to the infirmary for the night shift. They had little medicine or food to offer their patients. Comfort and kindness were all they had left to give. Nurse Still heard gunfire the next morning at dawn and assumed the massacre had begun. She steeled herself to glance out the infirmary window and saw parachutes gliding to the ground. Liberation had come just in time. U.S. and Filipino forces swiftly evacuated the 2,400 inmates to safety. But that wasn't the end of Nurse Still's journey. She was haunted by the horrors she witnessed in the prison camp, and the trauma stuck with her for the rest of her life. Now nursing leaders and advocates are saying the problem of not addressing nurses' mental health needs has again reached a critical point. Nurses have been on the front lines of the COVID-19 crisis, but most are not receiving comprehensive mental health screening or treatment. Nursing advocacy groups and scholars who study PTSD in nursing warn that leaving nurses' mental health needs untreated could lead to a nursing shortage, much as it did after World War II. Back in the States, Nurse Still was tasked with speaking at war bond drives about the 3 years she was a prisoner of war. She found the experience troubling and requested a transfer to Panama, but her memories followed her to her new post. At times, she was depressed. Other times, she couldn't stop thinking about all she had endured. She sometimes cried without provocation and struggled to stop crying once she had started. On the advice of her fiancé, she booked an appointment with a naval physician. During her appointment, Nurse Still told the physician she had been a prisoner of war for more than 3 years and asked for a medical discharge based on the trauma she was experiencing. The doctor asked Nurse Still was liberated. The date was the same day as the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. The physician said those men were heroes, but Nurse Still was a woman and a nurse, and therefore did not suffer. Denied treatment, Nurse Still left the appointment shaking. She vowed she would keep her pain to herself. The Navy nurses weren't the only medical care providers taken prisoner during World War II. 66 U.S. Army nurses, as well as hundreds of physicians, pharmacists, and medical assistants, were also held captive in the South Pacific. But at the end of the war, as the U.S. prepared to welcome home millions of men and women who served their country, mental health treatment was limited and reserved for men. Nurses, it was assumed, did not suffer. At the time, the U.S. military was the largest employer of nurses. It had established an expected code of silence regarding how nurses responded to their own trauma. In 1947, an article in the American Journal of Psychiatry claimed that a military hospital was a controlled environment that insulated nurses from the brutality of war. The study's author claimed that nurses' mental health needs were less complex and that nursing fulfilled women by catering to their natural instinct to care for men. They were supplying a service which gratified the passive needs of men and which identified these women with the wife, the mother, or the sweetheart back at home. Many nurses, including Nurse Still, responded to the lack of mental health treatment by leaving both the military and nursing. The late 1940s saw a shortage of nurses at a time when hospital admissions rose by 26%. The shortage persisted until the late 1960s, when wages began to increase. The COVID-19 pandemic has meant that for the first time since World War II, the vast majority of U.S. nurses are embroiled in fighting a common enemy. It's a demanding and emotional battle that advocates say adds a deeper stress to an already taxing job. Across the country, nurses have been caring for patients dying from COVID-19 who do not have the support of family at their bedside due to visitor restrictions. The nurses are often the ones who are serving as the loved one and helping the patient navigate the end-of-life journey, says Holly Carpenter, a senior policy advisor with the American Nurses Association. In addition to caring for dying COVID-19 patients, Carpenter says, many nurses were not properly equipped at the height of the pandemic with personal protection equipment needed to avoid infection. These nurses lived in fear of being infected or transmitting the virus to loved ones at home. And on top of these stressors, nurses are also still coping with the usual demands of the job. There are the things that have always been there: long shifts, sometimes mandatory overtime, a workload that's heavier than you're comfortable with, having to work through breaks or lunchtime, having to come in early and stay late, Carpenter says. Prior to the pandemic, studies estimated that as many as half of critical care nurses experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Since the pandemic began, researchers have found the crisis has amplified symptoms of mental health problems. A 2020 study in General Hospital Psychiatry found that 64% of nurses in a New York City medical center reported experiencing acute stress. Acute stress included symptoms like nightmares, inability to stop thinking about COVID-19, and feeling numb, detached, and on guard, says study leader Marwa Abdallah, a clinical cardiologist and assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. This is concerning. We know that if these symptoms persist for more than a month, it can lead to PTSD. A person is diagnosed with PTSD if they meet criteria outlined by the DSM-5, the psychiatric profession's official manual. Criteria include experiencing or witnessing or learning about a traumatic event, such as a death, serious injury, or sexual violence, intrusive symptoms like dreams and flashbacks, avoidance of reminders of the event, negative changes in thoughts and moods, and behavioral changes. A person can also develop PTSD if they are repeatedly exposed to the details of a traumatic event. Suffering from undiagnosed or untreated PTSD is a life-altering condition with diverse ramifications and may lead a nurse to leave healthcare. We're potentially setting up an occupational healthcare crisis, Abdallah says. This has long-term implications for the healthcare industry and our ability to deliver adequate healthcare for our patients. Carpenter says healthcare organizations must be proactive with screening nurses for symptoms related to anxiety, depression, and PTSD. Such screenings must be confidential and come with the assurance that a nurse's license or job will not be compromised. Organizations also need to work to destigmatize mental health diagnosis and treatment. Historically, nurses are always looked upon as the healers and the helpers, Carpenter says. They feel the need to be strong for other people. What do you do when the hero needs help? For Nurse Still, help never came. She left the Navy and nursing, married, and had 3 children. She returned to nursing in the late 1950s after her husband suddenly died and she needed to support her family. Only in the 1990s did she begin speaking about her experiences in interviews with oral historians and documentary producers. She also wrote a memoir, but kept the story light and did not disclose her extensive suffering. The profession has advanced since Nurse Still's 1940s appeal for mental health support was rejected. We do recognize the full PTSD, compassion fatigue, and burnout of nurses. It's been chronicled now, and we understand it, Carpenter says. Now the challenge is encouraging each nurse to seek and receive help. Otherwise, advocates warn, their health and well-being will continue to decline, and history may repeat as stress nurses leave a strained profession. Building an astronaut's diet. For healthy and happy space travelers, food scientists must make meals compact, nutritious, and long-lasting. Food is the key to our daily functions, fueling our activity and fortifying our bodies and minds. But most of us with access to various food sources don't need to worry about meal prepping quite as much as NASA. In space, where astronauts confront drastic environmental and physical changes, the need for safe, nutritious, and energy-laden food is particularly vital to overall health. But for those traveling far from Earth's food supply, it's particularly challenging to produce, transport, and prepare healthy food. Beyond providing energy and nourishment, space meals must be palatable and stay safe for consumption for months or even years. Above all, space food must provide adequate energy to fuel astronauts on their grueling missions, according to NASA. Without a sufficient caloric intake, which exceeds earthly needs and ranges between about 2,700 to 3,700 daily calories, astronauts risk losing body mass, a key marker of nutrition. In microgravity, proper nutrition can combat the resulting degradation of bones and muscles. In general, if it's good for you on Earth, it's going to be good for you on space flights, says Grace Douglas, lead scientist for NASA's Advanced Food Technology Research Group at the Johnson Space Center. After decades of nutritional studies and food technology advancements, NASA has shifted focus away from supplements and dietary formulas and towards providing as many nutrients from fruits and vegetables as possible. Food derived from a variety of natural sources can provide a variety of phytochemicals, or biologically active compounds, that you can't get from dietary supplements. It can be difficult to rely heavily on fruits and vegetables as a space food source because while they can be packed with nutrients, they don't contain many calories. This poses an issue for spaceflight, where cargo room is precious. To get food to an acceptable mass and increase its shelf life, the NASA Food Systems team uses technology like freeze-drying. It's then stored in the spacecraft with inflexible, lightweight packaging that looks a lot like the tuna packets sold in grocery stores. Space food scientists must ensure their products remain shelf-stable for months, sometimes years. NASA can't merely consider health when designing space food, though. The nutritional value of a meal only goes so far if it doesn't appeal to astronauts. Douglas and her colleagues aim to offer astronauts several options to avoid menu fatigue. Such variety also provides psychological health benefits. Food becomes more important with mission duration, isolation, and confinement because it's one of the only familiar things that they have, Douglas says. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.